Succession number 9876, reel 12.
Mr. Dennis, reel 12. Besides the sort of liaison with the British artillery that you mentioned, did you have any other duties as liaison officer?
No, it was only for artillery purposes.
So there were other British liaison officers there, were there, for other units?
There weren't, you know, and I don't know why. But I was certainly the only British officer there. Actually, of course, quite obviously, I was able to tell the brigade, who would be able to tell corps and so on, things that weren't strictly in the artillery field, anything else of interest there was. But the French general, I could see his cavalry attacking some woods, and they went in and there was firing. They didn't come out again, so I think they must have turned the Germans out the other in the other direction. Anyway, the front stabilized.
Now, while you were attached as liaison officer, did you live with the French, so to speak, or did you just go over there each day?
I cannot remember living with them. I certainly didn't mess with them. But either I must have, my batman must have brought me rations, and in which case I picnics, or else I must have gone in the evening, because I can't remember sleeping there. It was only 2 or 3 days.
So this was in April, we're into April
in
now.
April, yes. And then we got orders. Lots more French came up, and we got orders to go north, and we went north to a position covering Amiens.
Still with Fifth Army, or were you?
No, Fifth Army was officially became Fourth Army when Gough was sacked. Rawlinson was brought in. It became 4th Army. It made no difference to us. But we went up there, and we found that we were in support of the Australians, who had field guns, but no heavy guns at all. Now, I found this period of my war very enjoyable, because I suppose that the atmosphere satisfied me. I liked. I still like Australians.
What was it you liked then about them?
Well, it seemed to me that they were friendly, and they were quite uninhibited. I liked being treated as I was by the Australians, is just not a bloody awful pommy, but just another person. And the Australians suggested that as we were having a few days without any particular battle going on, it was surely the moment to have a test match. They found a bit of unshelled ground within reach of their positions and ours, and we or they or both got some equipment, the bats and balls and bales and stumps, and we were there, and we played cricket with them. And what the Germans could have thought was going on, I can't imagine, because it must have been reported by some German. Unfortunately, next morning, when the Australians were assembling on the cricket pitch, and we were on the way to it, they were heavily shelled. Some were killed and some were wounded, and the ground was ruined. And
this was for a return match, was it?
It was to be the second day, yes, the return match, but we couldn't play it.
Do you remember anything about the first match? I don't expect you will.
No. Except that.
Were you playing yourself?
I must have been, I think, but I don't remember. Yes, I must have been playing.
Now, with the Australians, you were back with your battery. You weren't liaison, were you?
Oh, no. Back with the battery. But we used to send a man forward. And we were involved in a very interesting battle on... July. It must have been in July.
Was this at Villers Bretonneux?
Yes, yes. There were two battles. There was the battle specifically for the hill and village of Villers Bretonneux. There was a later battle on the 8th of August for the whole front, including that. But this was a battle where the Germans had the very good idea of seizing the hill of Villers Bretonneux and thereby getting observation all over the Allied railway system, Amiens and all those. I pass through Villers Bretonneux now occasionally when I go to France. Well, what happened was that in the morning the Germans put up a barrage. Nasty, but not particularly memorable. Awful lot of gas shell, I remember, because they'd intended to put as many batteries out as they could out with gas shelling. They did get some, but not us. And the morning wore on, and still pretty unpleasant. The Australian command organised a night counterattack from both flanks, so I think the British division helped them, and they came together and they pinched out Villers-Bretonneux, and they found that a lot of the Germans were in the cellars of the village, hors de combat with gas, their own gas, because when the counterattack took place, they'd fled for the cellars, of course, and the cellars had been so badly contaminated, it's mustard gas was, and so the Australians firmly had Villers Bretonneux in their own possession again until August the 8th, when they made a big push, by which time we were up north again.
What part did you play in the battle, the first battle?
Villers Bretonneux, I was in the battery position, I think, sort of overseeing some of the firing. Certainly I wasn't forward. I remember the circumstances. During the night, my tunic was hanging on a nail in a small house. I was on bed underneath it, and in the morning I found a shell splinter had gone clean through it. So I was glad it was on the nail and not on me.
You say you went north. This was before August the 8th?
Then? Yes, before August the 8th. We were moved north to take part in an offensive to recapture the ground lost in the Ypres salient, because we'd had to, during the German offensive, we'd had to give up the ground, and now we had to recapture it from them.
This would be the fourth Battle of Ypres.
It was the fourth, yes, but it was so different from the other. It was entirely moving, this one. The ground was as filthy as ever. But the Germans, I think what they wanted to do was to evacuate the salient and find somewhere strong further on. And so it seemed to me that they didn't really... They didn't put up their ordinary resistance, I thought.
What happened when you arrived? Which sector of the line had they attacked? The advance started already when you got there, or were you in on the start?
I don't remember, I'm afraid. I don't remember any sort of big barrage or anything. I think it must have started when I got there.
So what was the situation that you do remember?
What I do remember was following up the retreating Germans and being ordered to go as far as I could and find out where the line had got to. But by this time the Germans were really going back in a hell of a lick. And this was... And I remember that I felt grand that day. I felt just right. I felt the Germans were running. The war's not going to last very long, and I'm feeling well. And I followed them into still no signs of Germans. And I found that I was in one of those little towns on the Flemish border, Menin, I think.
So you'd advanced quite a long way by then?
Oh, long way. It's the longest walk I'd ever done in my life, that one. But I found myself alone in, I think it must have been Menin, a town, not destroyed. I think the infantry probably got through it, and I was behind them somewhere. But it was very eerie, because I felt that at any moment someone would pop out of the cellar and catch me in the back when I wasn't looking. But it amused me, because I claimed that I could claim to have conquered the town of Menin. But when I got home in the evening, I had very bad news. My best friend, the commander of the heavy battery, of the siege battery with the super heavy guns, a man called Baines, Cuthbert Baines, he'd been in action in what was part of the old Ypres salient. It's a place called Oud-Cruzec. I didn't even need to reproduce all this. And while he was taking charge of his battery's fire, he was hit in the throat with a shell splinter. And he died. And by the time I got back, they buried him, and I never saw him again. But he was a man who'd taken great interest in me. He was older than me, and he'd encouraged me to listen to music and to read books worth reading and this kind of thing. And he was rather a loss.
How did it affect you? Did it?
Well, you know, you hadn't time to let these things make very much difference to what you did. It was just that I felt that I'd had a bad loss. Because it was so near the end of the war, and he had an interesting war. He'd been a permanent civil servant in the Colonial Office, and the Colonial Office had forbade him to join the forces. Upon which he joined the forces, and they then wrote him a series of threatening letters saying that they would terminate his appointment if he survived for this act of indiscipline. However, he didn't take any notice, and they didn't terminate his appointment, but the Germans did.
Any other incidents you remember from the advance? Because you got Spanish flu during this advance.
Spanish flu. That must have been... Now, where the devil was that? Anyway, I got Spanish flu later on in the war, and I was at that time living in what we called a dugout, but it wasn't a dugout, it was built up sandbags and corrugated iron on the roof. And I felt rather ill and I went to bed. And I can't remember what happened. Someday I was seen by the brigade's medical officer, who knew it was Spanish flu, but I think I was rather lucky not being taken out and sent to hospital. I probably did better where I was. And when I got up, I suddenly found I was feeling much better, and I started to ring round and ask about my friends, and I found a surprising number of people I knew had died of it.
What were the symptoms as far as you were concerned?
Just ordinary flu.
It wasn't any worse than...
No, it just seemed like ordinary flu. What happened to people was that usually when they were getting slightly better, they had a relapse, a collapse of, I think it would be the heart.
Now, I believe you've got a story about how you found some ill Germans in a dugout who may have been victims.
That was on the following them in the back through the salient. What happened was that there were no infantry inside, they were ahead somewhere, and something made me look inside an old German dugout. I saw a man there alive on a stretcher looking extremely ill. I thought, well, what the hell am I going to do about him? Because no one will find him if he's there. I can't stay. And I thought the only thing I could do for him was to get my chaps to take his stretcher out of the dugout and put it on the side of the road and make sure he had water in his water bottle. And that's all we could do. But I did mention, I think, to some infantry that there was a casualty there who might be removed, but I don't think they were very interested.
This was a German.
German.
And he was suffering from flu.
Well, I didn't know what he was suffering from. I couldn't tell. And I couldn't speak German and he couldn't speak English. But he looked to me as if he had fever. Probably flu.
Now, as the war, as the war came to a close, as the advance continued, are there any more memories you have of that advance or any remaining impressions before the armistice?
Just when we got out through the salient and we were advancing towards the pack of towns, Courtrai and Lille and those towns. And I remember that we had a rather close shave from a shell in a field of cabbages, and I thought to myself, oh my God, I don't want to get killed now. I think the war's coming to an end.
Did that affect your morale or your willingness to take risks, do you think?
Well, it made it more difficult. I don't know to what extent I evaded the risks, and to what extent, but I know that it was harder to do it.
What, to do what you were ordered to do?
Anything. Or, well, one wasn't ordered to do very much. Mostly you knew jolly well what you had to do. And I didn't want to, and it was dangerous.
Did you have four FOOs out during the open warfare advance?
No, I never had any of that work.
Did the battery have them out, though, or were you firing on map references to the request of the infantry?
I think we were firing on map references. But mainly, the truth was that we were lumbering after the Germans, trying to catch them up. When we finally got them, we were in a position which was terrible. We and the other batteries, were English batteries, were overlooking the Scheldt River, or Scheldt, I think the Dutch call it. And I remember that it was a terribly exposed position, and it seemed to us that if there was a battle, which was obviously blowing up, we were going to have a pretty rough time of it. But before it could come, we had this news, the effect that at 11 a.m. on the 11th of November 1918, hostilities were going to cease, and that there was to be no firing from then onwards. And so we sat round, and we couldn't believe it. It didn't seem that this could be really happening. And just before the 11th, just before 11 a.m., it occurred to us and to a number of other batteries that it would be very annoying to be left with loaded guns which we couldn't fire, because unloading is an awful nuisance with big guns, and you have to be jolly careful what you do. So we thought, we and all the other batteries, I must have had the same idea, because just before the 11 o'clock, there were a series of sounds of gunfire from up and down the line. What we did was to cock our guns up to an angle which we felt made it certain no one was going to get killed, because by this time we didn't want to slay somebody in the last few minutes. And so we tried to, and this was the other people, the same thing, tried to just fire the guns and let it go.
This last firing, were you all very conscious of not trying to kill anyone with it? I mean, it was
I think everybody at the final moment didn't want to do any more damage.
Did you talk to each other about how you felt about the end of the war? Or?
Well, we tried to, but really, until the 11 o'clock arrived, there wasn't much you could say. Then we sat down and we began to talk about what we were going to do after the war. I said I was going to go back to Oxford and pick up my scholarship. Two colleagues of mine who were farmers said they were going back to their farms. The major, who was a regular, said that he would look out whether he could get something else to do, because he thought the army in peacetime wasn't going to be his line of country, and it wasn't either. Actually, he went in the Sudan Civil Service and did rather well.
Did anyone think, I mean, he was a regular, but did anyone think of staying in the army in those?
Yes, some did. Some chaps did. Mostly chaps who hadn't been out any length of time thought that, well, he has an occupation, it's not bad, and took it.
How did you feel in yourself about the end of the war?
Relieved. Relieved. I had always, I mean, this consciousness of that any moment might be your last, was never away from my mind. Even when I was enjoying myself, for a long time my ears were always attuned to the sound of a shell. And I used to find that when I went by tube, the noise the tube trains made was much too like a heavy shell for my, that kind of thing, yes. But mainly the answer to your question is relieved.
Now, what happened to the battery? Wasn't broken up immediately because you weren't demobilised straight away. What happened after the?
Well, after the armistice, we were put out, we and all the other units, in convenient locations. Ours was, we had billets at Tourcoing. And the only thing I can tell you that might be of interest about that period of the war was that the military authorities, feeling, I suppose, that anything might happen if we were left entirely unoccupied, thought that the proper thing to do was to smarten us up. And amongst other smartening measures, there was a corps parade on Sunday, a church parade, to which we were all to appear polished and clean and shaved and so on. Now, this was a mistake. The troops, the last thing they wanted was anything military. They'd just come to the end of that and they didn't want anything else. And so, one fine morning, Sunday, my chaps, I've been left in charge, by the way, because the major was on leave and we hadn't got a captain, so I was in charge, and they didn't come out of their billet to form up for the church parade. And so I thought to myself, this is, don't blame them for this, but it won't do like this at all. So I told Brigade this. I said, I think that's just a sporting chance that I could get them out for a parade which I took.
A battery parade.
Yes, a battery parade and not anything else. And the answer was, for God's sake, get them out for anything you can, anyhow. So I sent a message in by one of the NCOs to the rooms where the men were. And I said, the corps parade has been cancelled, but there's going to be a battery parade instead, which Mr. Dennis will take. And I waited and I wondered, what happens if nothing happens? And then they all came out, and I took them away out of earshot of anybody who should better not be hearing, and I made everybody sit down and smoke, and I said, look, you know what happened this morning. Now look, there are about a million men, and God knows what equipment, in this country. There's only a certain amount of shipping, and if you don't obey orders and you just do anything, you and I and everybody else will never get home at all. So when you get orders to do something, for Christ's sake, do it. And I thought I'd risk something which else. And I said, we had a pretty rotten time over the last year or two together, and we've got on without quarrelling, and I think it'd be a great pity if we quarrelled now. Is anything special bothering you? and the voice came from the back saying, "No, sir, we're just fed up." And I said, "Well, I don't believe you for that, so am I." And so that finished it, and they never had any more corps raids. And then shortly after that, I was sent home to be demobilized because I was a student.
Now, they not turned out then because the grievance was not only about the corps parade and the bull for that, but also because of the slowness of demobilisation. Would that be?
It wasn't so much. It was. I don't think the men thought that demobilisation could be much quicker. But what they'd made a terrible mistake, you see, in England. They had made a scientific scheme by which key men would all be demobilized first and other men later. And this didn't take account of the fact that a chap who just arrived in France might be demobilized before a man who'd been out 4 years and wounded twice. And that's